Welcome to Learning English from the Voice of America. I'm Katie Weaver. Our 30-minute program of news and features is designed for English learners. So we speak a little slowly, using simple sentences and a limited vocabulary. On the show today, we hear part of another What It Takes podcast from the American Academy of Achievement. We close the show, as always, with an American story. Also later, Ashley Thompson and I have a doggone good story from the American Kennel Club. But first, we hear about an exciting archaeological find in Jerusalem. Here's Phil Dierking.
Archaeologists in Israel have recovered a seal impression that they say confirms the existence of Jerusalem governors identified in ancient religious writings. The researchers say the impression was discovered in an archaeological project in the Western Wall Plaza of Jerusalem. The small clay object has a message written in the ancient Hebrew language. It says, "Belonging to the governor of the city." The archaeologists say the impression could have been placed on shipments from the city leader to another leader or important person. For historians, the discovery from the first temple period of Jerusalem is evidence that the city had a governor at least 2,700 years ago. A Jerusalem governor is identified two times in the Bible, the Holy Book of Judaism and Christianity. Until now, there has never been any historical evidence of such a position. Shlomit Wexler Bedola is with Israel's Antiquity Authority. She says this is the first time that researchers have found evidence of the governor in an archaeological dig around a structure from 2,700 years ago. The seal impression shows two men facing each other and wearing striped clothing. They are holding a round object between them, which might be the moon. Wexler Bedola says the meaning of the image is unclear. Archaeologists know that the moon was considered an object of worship in neighboring cultures. Yet, this does not explain why the image would show the governor of Jerusalem in what appears to be a position of worship, showing respect to the moon. The archaeologists discovered the clay object sometime last year while they were examining dirt from the dig in Jerusalem's old city. The seal impression does not have the name of Jerusalem on it. Yet, archaeologists say the area where the impression was found proves that it shows a Jerusalem governor. They say it also proves that the city has been an important center of a Jewish state for around 3,000 years.
The governor of the city is reminded several times in the Bible, in several cities. The governor of Jerusalem is reminded twice, but we never found him actually in an archaeological excavation. So that's the big importance.
The archaeologists are publicizing their discovery at a time of growing tension around Jerusalem. Recently, United States President Donald Trump recognized the city as Israel's capital. The official standing of Jerusalem is a sensitive issue in the conflict between Israelis and Palestinians. The Palestinians want the eastern part of the city as the capital of their future state.
The American Kennel Club or AKC, has increased its membership. New to the AKC pack are an energetic dog whose main interest is ducks and a friendly dog that would rather chase rabbits. The American Kennel Club announced Wednesday that it is recognizing the Nederlandse Quakerhandje and the Grand Basset Griffon Vendéen. They are the first breeds added to the roster in 2 years. The newly added breeds are permitted to compete in many dog shows this year, but they are not yet able to take part in the biggest show. They will have to wait until 2019 to enter the Westminster Kennel Club show, held in New York City.
The Nederlandse Quakerhandje has been around for hundreds of years in Holland. They are called Quakers for short. The pretty brown and white dogs can be seen in some Dutch Old Master paintings. Deanne Noop Siderius breeds Quakers. They're actually like a toddler that never grows up, she said. She describes the dogs as happy, sometimes naughty, and very playful. Quakers were trained to help hunters move ducks into water traps called cooies. The practice fell from popularity in the 1800s, and the dogs almost disappeared. There are now about 7,000 left worldwide. The first recorded American litter was born in 1999. It is still a rare breed in the country, with about 500 in the U.S. Quakers will compete in the sporting dog group.
The Grand Basset Griffon Vendéen goes by GBGV for short. The Basset breed has deep roots in Europe. A smaller cousin, the Petit Basset Griffon Vendéen, and the long-eared Basset Hound have been recognized by the AKC for many years. GBGVs have long, rough fur. They are native to France. They weigh around 18 to 20 kilograms and stand fairly low to the ground. They are members of the Hound group. GBGVs are known for their speed, lasting energy, and good-natured personalities. Megan Escherich is a dog trainer in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. She also owns a 9-year-old GBGV named Juno. She says the breed is pretty laid back. They're happy to get up and do things if you ask them to, but they're not particularly busy in terms of pacing back and forth or throwing a ball in your lap, she said. Juno has competed in agility, obedience, and other events. Experts say GBGVs enjoy children and family life, but are not easy to train. The breed might not be the best choice for a first-time dog owner.
The AKC is the nation's oldest purebred dog registry. It recognizes 192 breeds, from silky Afghan hounds to the Sholowitz Quintly, also called the Mexican hairless dog. The AKC does not consider recognition of a breed unless there are at least 300 of the dogs spread across at least 20 states. Some animal rights supporters say working to increase interest in purebreds is wrong. They say it leads to cruel breeding operations. Activists also argue that too many dogs are in public shelters already and need owners. The AKC says responsible breeding permits people to choose pets with somewhat predictable characteristics. The club also notes that mixed breed dogs compete in many events it supports, such as agility and obedience competitions.
Now, here is Alice Winkler with What It Takes.
Meet Ray Dalio. He's the subject of this episode of What It Takes. Ray Dalio is the most successful hedge fund manager of all time.
I don't know what a hedge fund is. I really don't know.
While Ray Dalio struggles with that one for a moment, let me remind you, What It Takes is a podcast about passion, vision, and perseverance from the Academy of Achievement's archive of interviews with extraordinary people.
Padme, this child is gifted. And I heard that enough that I started to believe it.
If you have the opportunity, not a perfect opportunity, and you don't take it, you may never have another chance.
It all was so clear. It was just like the picture started to form itself.
There was no way in which a lie could prevail over the truth. Darkness over light, death over life.
Every day I wake up and decide, today I'm going to love my life. Decide.
My advice is, if they're going to break your leg once when you go in that place, stay out of there.
And then along come these differential experiences that you don't look for, you don't plan for, but boy, you better not miss them.
Ray Dalio founded the investment firm Bridgewater Associates, and they manage $150 billion. That's billion with a B. So what does Ray Dalio mean exactly when he says he doesn't know what a hedge fund is?
So it's a structure within which investors can do all different things. Like a mutual fund, you might say some people are value investors. Some people invest in bonds. Some people invest in stocks. People do all different things within a structure called a hedge fund. Basically, though, it allows you to invest without much in the way of restrictions, traditional ways. I can sell short as well as go long. If I think something will go down, I can sell short. I can go into any market. I can go into stocks or bonds or commodities or gold or anywhere that I want to go within my agreement with my client. So I give me the freedom to approach the world to look at whatever's good or whatever's bad.
In short, I think what he's saying in this 2012 interview is it's vague. So if you don't quite get what a hedge fund is after all these years, you can finally stop feeling bad about it. If Ray Dalio doesn't know, why should you? But hedge funds have made Ray Dalio a wealthy man, a very, very wealthy man. He's worth about $15 billion. Dalio began investing when he was a child, literally.
I started trading markets when I was 12. You know, it was interesting at the time I caddied at a local golf course. But this was a very, very elite in the sense of, you know, I caddied for Richard Nixon. I caddied for the Duke of Windsor. In fact, that caddied for very interesting people at that golf course. And at the time, also, there was Wall Street crowd, and this was in the 60s. And at the time, the United States was on top of the world. Stocks kept going up, and everybody talked about the stock market. So it looks precocious, more precocious than it was. It was just what people were talking about, and I certainly was interested in having those conversations, and I was interested in that experience. So, yes, I bought stocks, or I bought a stock, Northeast Airlines. It was the first stock I bought. My whole criteria were, it was the only company I ever heard of that was selling for less than $5 a share. And I figured if I, less than $5 a share, I can buy more shares. I mean, dumb, right? But it turned out that that company was about to be acquired, it was about to go broke. Somebody acquired it and it tripled or went up a lot. And I made money. And then as a result of that, I got interested. And it was the thing to talk about. So I could talk with Wall Street people when we were walking down the course about what stocks were good and bad and that interaction. And because I was speaking to them about the stock market and they were really nice people, we had those quality conversations. And then I began the process.
That process has continued for the 5 decades since. But the process Dalio is really talking about here is not how he figured out the markets and accumulated unimaginable wealth. It's more about the process of Ray Dalio's enlightenment. Probably the most important thing to know about Dalio, besides the financial success of his firm, is that he's a kind of self-help evangelist. He has spent a lot of time thinking about what it takes to succeed in life as well as in business, and he loves to share those thoughts.
I think for everybody, in order to be successful, there are 5 steps that you go through, essentially.
To hear the whole podcast, go to the What It Takes section on our website, learningenglish.voanews.com. Next, an American story. Today, we hear part 1 of A Princess of Mars by Edgar Rice Burroughs.
I am a very old man. How old, I do not know. It is possible I am 100, maybe more. I cannot tell, because I have never aged as other men do. So far as I can remember, I have always been a man of about 30. I appear today as I did 40 years ago. Yet, I feel that I cannot go on living forever. Someday, I will die the real death from which there is no escape. I do not know why I should fear death, I, who have died 2 times, and am still alive. I have never told this story. I know the human mind will not believe what it cannot understand. I cannot explain what happened to me. I can only tell of the 10 years my dead body lay undiscovered in an Arizona cave. My name is John Carter. I am from the state of Virginia. At the close of the Civil War, I found myself without a home, without money, and without work. I decided the best plan was to search for gold in the great deserts of the American Southwest. I spent almost a year searching for gold with another former soldier, Captain James Powell, also of Virginia. We were extremely lucky. In the winter of 1865, we found rocks that held gold. Powell was trained as a mining engineer. He said we had uncovered over $1 million worth of gold in only 3 months. But the work was slow, with only 2 men and not much equipment. So we decided Powell should go to the nearest settlement to seek equipment and men to help us with the work. On March 3rd, 1866, Powell said goodbye. He rode his horse down the mountain toward the valley. I followed his progress for several hours. The morning Powell left was like all mornings in the deserts of the Great Southwest, clear and beautiful. Not much later, I looked across the valley. I was surprised to see three riders in the same place where I had last seen my friend. After watching for some time, I decided the three riders must be hostile Indians. Powell, I knew, was well armed and an experienced soldier, but I knew he would need my aid. I found my weapons, placed a saddle on my horse, and started as fast as possible down the trail taken by Powell. I followed as quickly as I could until dark. About 9 o'clock, the moon became very bright. I had no difficulty following Powell's trail. I soon found the trail left by the three riders following Powell. I knew they were Indians. I was sure they wanted to capture Powell. Suddenly, I heard shots far ahead of me. I hurried ahead as fast as I could. Soon, I came to a small camp. Several hundred Apache Indians were in the center of the camp. I could see Powell on the ground. I did not even think about what to do. I just acted. I pulled out my guns and began shooting. The Apaches were surprised and fled. I forced my horse into the camp and toward Powell. I reached down and pulled him up on the horse by his belt. I urged the horse to greater speed. The Apaches, by now, realized that I was alone and quickly began to follow. We were soon in very rough country. The trail I chose began to rise sharply. It went up and up. I followed the trail for several hundred meters more until I came to the mouth of a large cave. It was almost morning now. I got off my horse and laid Powell on the ground. I tried to give him water, but it was no use. Powell was dead. I laid his body down and continued to the cave. I began to explore the cave. I was looking for a safe place to defend myself, or perhaps for a way out, but I became very sleepy. It was a pleasant feeling. My body became extremely heavy. I had trouble moving. Soon, I had to lay down against the side of the cave. For some reason, I could not move my arms or legs. I lay facing the opening of the cave. I could see part of the trail that had led me here. And now, I could see the Apaches. They had found me, but I could do nothing. Within a minute, one of them came into the cave. He looked at me, but he came no closer. His eyes grew wide. His mouth opened. He had a look of terror on his face. He looked behind me for a moment and then fled. Suddenly, I heard a low noise behind me. So could the rest of the Apaches. They all turned and fled. The sound became louder, but still I could not move. I could not turn my head to see what was behind me. All day,
I lay like this. I tried again to rise, and again, but I still could not move. Then I heard a sharp sound. It was like a steel wire breaking. I quickly stood up. My back was against the cave wall. I looked down. There before me lay my body. For a few moments, I stood looking at my body. I could not bring myself to touch it. I was very frightened. The sounds of the cave and the sight of my body forced me away. I slowly backed to the opening of the cave. I turned to look at the Arizona night. I could see 1,000 stars. As I stood there, I turned my eyes to a large red star. I could not stop looking at it. It was Mars, the red planet, the red god of war. It seemed to pull me near. Then, for a moment, I closed my eyes. There was an instant of extreme cold and total darkness. Suddenly, I was in deep, dreamless, peaceful sleep. I opened my eyes upon a very strange land. I immediately knew then I was on Mars. Not once did I question this fact. My mind told me I was on Mars, as your mind tells you that you are upon Earth. You do not question the fact, nor did I. I found myself lying on a bed of yellow-colored grass that covered the land for kilometers. The time was near the middle of the day, and the sun was shining full upon me. It was warm. I decided to do a little exploring. Springing to my feet, I received my first Martian surprise. The effort to stand carried me into the Martian air to the height of about 1 meter. I landed softly upon the ground, however, without incident. I found that I must learn to walk all over again. My muscles were used to the gravity of Earth. Mars has less gravity. My attempts to walk resulted in jumps and hops, which took me into the air. I once landed on my face. I soon learned that it took much less effort for me to move on Mars than it did on Earth. Near me was a small, low wall. Carefully, I made my way to the wall and looked over. It was filled with eggs, some already broken open. Small, green creatures were in them. They looked at me with huge red eyes. As I watched the fierce-looking creatures, I failed to hear 20 full-grown Martians coming from behind me. They had come without warning. As I turned, I saw them. One was coming at me with a huge spear, with its sharp tip pointed at my heart.
We have come to the end of today's show, but we'll be back tomorrow, same time, same place. Hope you will tune in then. For VOA Learning English, I'm Katie Weaver. Thanks for listening.